Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings is one of the most read, or is the most read, book in the world today. So it's worth pausing to ask why, especially since the author infused the whole myth with his Catholic understanding, imagination, and faith. Tolkien was to write, "The Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, unconsciously so at first, but consciously in the revision. That's why I have not put in, or I've cut out, practically all references to anything like religion, to cults or practices in the imaginary world, for the religious element is absorbed into the story and the symbolism." Christians have found it difficult to find a language in which to talk to their neighbours about the love and justice of God, the struggle between good and evil, truth and untruth, and how much our taking up the quest in this struggle matters to our survival both now and beyond time. But Tolkien found such a language in myth, and perhaps the Church might try to do a better job of explaining to our society that the very reason it loves this myth is the same reason for taking the life of the soul more seriously. Did Tolkien set out to evangelize a lost world in this subtle but astonishingly potent way? Not at all. It seems to have happened to him and through him, a little like the quest happened to Frodo. He wrote of a visitor who startled him by saying, "Of course you don't suppose, do you, that you wrote the book all by yourself, pure Gandalf?" Tolkien replied, "I was too well acquainted with Gandalf to ask what he meant. I think I said, 'No, I don't suppose so any longer.' I've never since been able to suppose so. An alarming conclusion for an old philologist to draw concerning his private amusement." And you speak of a sanity and sanctity in The Lord of the Rings, which is a power in itself. I was deeply moved by this. Nothing of the kind has been sent to me before, but by a strange chance, just as I was beginning this letter, I had one from a man who classified himself as an unbeliever. "But you," he said, "create a world in which some sort of faith seems to be everywhere, without a visible source, like light from an invisible lamp." "I could only answer," said Tolkien, "of his own sanity no man can securely judge. If sanctity inhabits his work, or as a pervading light illumines it, then it does not come from him, but through him. And neither of you would perceive it in these terms unless it was with you also." So Tolkien tells us that he felt in creating it, as we feel in reading it, that it was discovered, not invented, that it had always been there. And it was as much a surprise to Tolkien to discover it as it is to us. He wrote, "I had the sense of recording what was already there somewhere, not of inventing." There are clues everywhere to the fact that this world of prehistory is the same world that the Jewish prophets and through the incarnation Jesus would give us a key to interpreting. God in Lord of the Rings is made known through providence in every page of the work. It is dense with destiny and providence. Though the events are surprises to the reader as to the protagonist, they also form a pattern, and we eventually see they all had to happen that way. Good and evil are presented not only in a way that is completely consistent with what we encounter in the Gospels, but in a way that invites the reader to share in the quest, to undermine and confront evil with heroism, self-sacrifice, wisdom, courage, and a refusal to give up or give in. By the act of reading, we enter into a world not only of imagination, but also of the spirit, so that both our wills and our souls become engaged in this quest for salvation. And there are subtle clues of the Catholic Christianity deliberately woven into the text. Galadriel is very like Our Lady, Theotokos, Mary, the Mother of Christ. In a letter to Father Murray, Tolkien writes about the book, "I think I know exactly what you mean by the order of grace, and of course by your reference to Our Lady, upon which all of my own small perception of beauty, both in majesty and simplicity, is founded." But this is presented as background music, for the novel is mythical, not creedal. On March the 25th, however, the Ring of Power was finally destroyed forever in the fire of Mount Doom. And later in the text we find it's the date that Samwise Gamgee's first daughter, Eleanor the Fair, is born. And in the life of the Catholic Church, March the 25th is both the day of Abraham's sacrifice and equally, or more important, the Feast of the Annunciation. If it is by the act of reading we enter this morally inspired, spiritually charged world, what happens when the plot and characters are moved into a different medium, that of film? Amazon have just launched their version of a prehistory of Tolkien's prehistory. Ferdinand Rouse is managing editor for the Catholic Herald and has been both reading and watching Tolkien for most of his life, developing both the expertise and affection for the original work. In order to assess the success or otherwise of this new commercial venture on film by Amazon, he joins me now.
Ferdy, thank you so much for coming and having this conversation. I have to say, of all the conversation I've had, this is one I've been looking forward to enormously because I just love Tolkien and Lord of the Rings. So I want to begin by asking you, before we offer your credentials to the waiting world, and there are some credentials, why do you love Lord of the Rings? When did you come across it first?
Well, I first came across it sort of many years ago, of course, back when the trilogy from Peter Jackson first came out. But as sort of the years progressed, I did actually start. I went through the literature a few times. I read the books in their entirety, and I've reread them at least three or four times at this point. And I must say, it's always been a source of joy for me to go back through. It is so just fundamentally uplifting to have that sort of sense of purpose and the sort of the significance that he brings across of essentially what is fundamentally decency, but is of course much more profound than that.
I know you're much younger than I am, but are you saying that you came across the Peter Jackson films before you came across the book?
Well, I mean, to be fair, I mean, the Peter Jackson films came out when I was six, so it was immediately in my consciousness.
Oh, this is terrible. I'm blown away by this.
In fairness, I mean, I feel some sort of comfort in not having come to it from the books, if only because I have the excuse of youth. I don't think anyone's really ready to read Tolkien until at least 15, 16, when you've actually got a bit of brain power behind you. Because it is actually quite... He does have very patient prose, and it's not difficult to appreciate, but it is more complex when you're younger. And I'm grateful having come back to it, to having read it as late as I did. If I'd read it earlier, I suspect I may have been put off by it.
Yes, there are a few very clever clogs, like Tom Holland, who says he read it when he was age 9 and understood every single word of it.
I'm clearly not as smart as those people, but I have no bad bones by the way I did it. I'm very, very pleased to come through that way.
Ferdy, nobody is as smart as Tom Holland. That's what Tom Holland tells us, and I'm sure he's right. Well, it's just astonishing to me that the time has gone by so quickly and that you came across the films first. I mean, the Jackson films are amazing. Did you always know that you were going to read the book once you'd seen the trilogy?
Honestly, no. But the films became such a feature of my generation's lifetime, really. It is sort of cultish. I have numerous friends who've done and I've done it myself, the Lord of the Rings marathon, watching all the extended editions in one go. But when you see that and you see the sort of the strength of it, you do a bit of research, there are unnumbered Tolkien Wikipedia and fandom pages. And when you sort of see that, you think it's not what got me to read it, was it felt insufficient. I mean, Jackson was fascinating, but it somehow lacked something.
Well, this is very good, because I think this is going to give us the trajectory of our conversation. This idea of what the films lack, because a lot of people ask what Tolkien was doing. Was he just telling a story? Is there much Christianity in? Is there Catholicism? How can there be any God when clearly there's no mention of God specifically? And most people who either read the films, and indeed most who read the book in my experience, don't have much understanding of the very sophisticated theology and metaphysics that lay behind it. And I think the clue to that maybe this is a conversation that should be had, and we're having in part, at least as a prelude, talking about the latest Amazon escapades, is exactly the point you've made, that there's something missing in the films. And I think there's quite a lot missing. How would you describe what you found missing once you got to the text?
It's an inevitable, really, with the transition between books and text, and that you do lose the sense of internal moral struggle. I mean, to be fair to Jackson, he does do an exceptional job of actually imposing this in visually. It's very, very well sort of handled. I mean, it's as well handled as it can be in a film, but it cannot be as profound a thought process as... So the example that I always sort of come back to, which is something which characterises all of the Lord of the Rings, is that duality between hope and despair. So, for instance, there's an extraordinary moment in the book, likewise in the film, when you have this huge triumphant charge by the Rohirrim, and they you know attack the forces of Sauron or the Witch King of Angmar, if I'm going to be too keen, and you have this moment when you see Théoden, who sits upon his horse, and he sort of has that moment of shock on his face as he sees the scale of the task before him. In the film, this is a 3-second shot, but in the book, Tolkien dedicates a minute to explaining what actually happened. So, you know, from the eyes of Merry, who's observing from behind, and he sees sort of, you know, the king slump as he sees it, as he becomes the old defeated man that he was in before his sort of, I suppose, in a sense, transfiguration in the Two Towers when he releases himself from Saruman. But over the course of about a minute, you have this, and he suddenly rises up and he gives a very stirring speech and then charges off into the distance like a, you know, fell he seemed on his steed, like his forefathers. And you have that sense of, even in the face of impossible odds and there's almost certain defeat, it is the right thing to do. What is effectively a minute of reading in the book, you have that sense of, that is the whole moral essence of what Tolkien is saying, which is to do what must be done because it is the right thing to be done, regardless of failure. And I think that is something which is something I ponder frequently. And it is just, there's such a weight in the way that Tolkien writes about it. He has this extraordinary style, which is this extraordinary mythic style, which gives a weight to that moral sort of reflection, which I think a lot of more recent, shall we say, exponents of the fantasy genre, particularly George R. R. Martin with Game of Thrones, it's more straightforward style in a sense. And so because it's more straightforward a style, it's more cynical. You can't have the same moral certainty without the language that Tolkien uses. Every aspect of what he does builds and grows to something which seems completely organic and not remotely proselytizing or pompous in its as I say, it's lacking everywhere else, and that's what makes Tolkien so unique, certainly for me.
So what you're saying, and certainly something that I feel too, is that within the text, there's an invitation to experience, I think, the quest, clearly the quest, but also this whole business of vocation and destiny. A lot of people complain that Tolkien hasn't written anything explicitly religious, but of course, all the wallpaper, the music, the framework, the landscape, is all full of Christian value, and he intended not to write about God, since in chronologically this is a pre-Christian time. But the whole universe he sets up is profoundly Christian in terms of its value. And what you've been describing, I think rather beautifully, is the way in which this value is expressed through people's sense of a vocation, of a quest, of a struggle that they're called to. And then as they take it up, all the Christian virtues of heroism, humility, self-sacrifice, and above all, the capacity to recognize the difference between power and love, power and compassion, power and duty, which is the great moral axis. These come through in the text. And the problem with the films, I enjoyed the films very much. They're easy, they're entertaining, you can sit back and be enjoyed. But of course, that's not what the text does. The text doesn't allow you to sit back. The text requires you to become part of the drama. You become part of the band. You join Bilbo. You join Frodo. You experience the emotions. You make your own moral choices along with them. And so there's something interactive reading the text that I think you miss when you sit back and have a film. And the filmmaker sets out to entertain you, sneakily borrowing all the archetypes, which are so powerful and which Tolkien had such intuitive and extraordinary access, but making it cheap entertainment. And instead of presenting before each one of us those series of moral choices, all of which we live through, I mean, one after the other, after the other, after the other. I mean, I remember the tragedy of Boromir. All one's vain, glorious ambition is caught up in Boromir, and that's that extraordinary self-deception. It doesn't matter who the character is, whether it's Boromir, Sauron, Gandalf, or Frodo. One has to make the moral choices along with them, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's so powerful.
But I think Boromir is a particularly interesting character because he does have, I mean, to be fair to him, Sean Bean does him rather well. But Boromir is an extraordinary character because he does have that, you know, in a sense, all of his desire to take the ring from Frodo, he's an honest one. And with that sort of his fall into, into his moral sort of breakdown when he lunges at Frodo, he immediately feels shame and he is able to redeem himself in that sort of excellent way.
He's that kind of political conscience of the church that slips over from depending on the Holy Spirit to depending upon political canniness. So he's decided he's going to do this by virtue of his own strength, his own courage, his own, for all of which is highly moral, but it's the wrong strength. It's the wrong virtue in the situation. And he fails to realize the virtues of the incarnation that Frodo represents. And it seems to me that great tussle is the same tussle the church always faces when it says to itself, maybe we can solve humanity's problems by doing the politics extremely well. It's a great temptation of liberation theology. Let's use Marx. Let's use the material that's around us. But in doing so, if the weight shifts so that one no longer depends upon the hiddenness of prayer and humility and that inner world of spirit that Frodo and Sam represent, then of course ultimately, well, it's Judas, isn't it? I mean, Boromir ultimately is Judas who gets to repent at the last second. So let's go on to the Amazon series. So we've already agreed there's a gap between the wonderful Peter Jackson films, and the gap is to do with the move from not being allowed the quest and instead being entertained. You've written a very powerful article for the Catholic Herald, which I hope everyone will go away and read. But can you give us a synopsis of it? When you and I talked about how we were both might write about this, I heard your molars grind. And if there'd been a camera, the camera would have had to make an aperture adjustment for the flames flashing from your eyes. You didn't think that the Amazon series did Tolkien justice. Is that right?
No, I don't. I think it... Just to give a bit of background about it, I think first, is that when it first sort of appeared, you thought, oh, you know, it cropped up 5 years ago, you think, oh, great, fantastic, Tolkien's coming back, super. But what was immediately frustrating about it was it wasn't clear what it was going to be about. And there's a peculiarity with terms of, you know, the rights that they actually had access to. I think they have the appendices of the Silmarillion or the Lord of the Rings. So a lot of what they've actually, the story that they've written, they haven't actually got permission to do, which is rather peculiar. In terms of the Second Age, which is what the story is about. But again, I shouldn't sort of get bogged down in that sort of financial aspect of it. I mean, that's between them and the Tolkien estate. But I think the essential problem is it was a financial concern. They wanted it to be the thing which put Amazon Studios on the map. And, you know, all of these things are typical ventures. But you did get the sense that it was written in a boardroom by sort of tick box here, you know, when they sort of said, well, you know, Hobbits didn't really exist in this time, but what's Middle Earth without hobbits? Okay, fine. Yeah, I rely on the creator for that one. But essentially, the long and short of this show is that it takes us back to, you know, roughly 4,000 years before the events of Lord of the Rings. Galadriel, who is sort of recast as this elven super soldier Terminator combination, who's utterly, totally powerful and just brilliant and genius and is absolutely right about everything, goes off in pursuit of Sauron, who killed her brother, and she's the only person who believes he's still out there. And by a bizarre sort of turn of circumstances, she manages to cross what is in the Tolkien universe about 8,000 miles in what is roughly about 5 hours of screen time in pursuit of her great enemy.
Can we just stop with what you said about Galadriel? You talked about the presentation of Galadriel as being a sort of a kick-ass warrioress. And that tells me that they haven't read or understood Tolkien. But the whole point of Galadriel is that she has this, I don't know how, because we're faced with the difficulty of how you describe magic in Tolkien, but I think magic in Tolkien is the life of the spirit. And so the elves are delightful because they understand what in Christian terms we'd call the life of the spirit. And Galadriel practices magic as in the fulsome life of the spirit, but she's terrified of power. And there's that incredible moment she draws herself up and takes the ring, or is about to take the ring. And Tolkien shows us that if she possessed the ring, all the goodness in her would become darkness. It would become evil, just like Sauron. In other words, power is so profoundly dangerous to the good person that it corrupts. And therefore, she refuses to be corrupted by power. Now, if you then take the Galadriel figure and say, well, let's have a very attractive, tall, blonde woman who's clearly got inner strength, and you then turn her into a kick-ass warrior princess, you completely missed the point. That's exactly what Galadriel refuses to be. And so, in a sense, the beauty and the complexity of her character is evacuated and she becomes a cartoon figure.
I do think that the essential point to sort of add to that is, you've actually outlined it far better than I could, in terms of Galadriel, again, that sort of internal moral sort of attempt to work out what's right and what's wrong. There is none of that. Possibly the most painful thing is that with this new series, it could have worked. But I think the biggest issue which draws itself away from Jackson is that Jackson made a point in an interview he did about this in 2002 with Charlie Rose, that he didn't want to put any of his own messages into the film. We wanted to treat it as history and allow Tolkien's messages to come through. And that's why Jackson's film lands so well, is that it maintains, even if it's got to compress and edit and remove, it does maintain the morality of each character. Whereas what is agonizing is that from the off, you're treated to a heroine, a protagonist who is right. We know she's right because we know that they wouldn't have made the show if she wasn't. But it is an agonizingly sort of frustrating watch because there's no moral debate in her you have to have a sense of a moral struggle, which you've got in Lord of the Rings, about her doing the right thing. It's just, I know that I'm right, and therefore. The justification that was put across for this was that, you know, this is a much younger Galadriel, she's sort of basically angsty teenager, which I find peculiar, seeing as she's still at this point about 2,000 years old, if not older.
There's a wonderful book by T.H. White called The Once and Future King, which is about the Arthurian legend. And again, it's in three bits, and the first part is cartoonish, and then it becomes more profound as it grows. But one of the great lessons that Arthur has to learn is that might is not right. And almost this is both White and Tolkien and Lewis in all their writing are trying to persuade the readers not to fall for the fascist, and I mean literally the fascist, either the fascist or the Marxist. But actually the fascist one is more dangerous because the Marxist invitation to sort the world out by strength has a certain ideological purity to it. Let's look after the underdog. Let's find justice. Let's make reparation. But the fascist one is so dangerous because with all its Nietzschean overtones, its might is right. There's something absolutely wonderful about being stronger than somebody else and using your strength, as the bully always does, to bring about your great delight, which is the destruction of all opposition. And the more beautiful the might is, the more tempting it is, which is why I think Hitler had such a thing about uniforms, to make the Nazis look particularly attractive. And they did look attractive visually. There's a very keen sense of the aesthetic bound up with the might is right escapade from the political right in the 20th century. And that's what they're doing. I mean, they're taking it's Boromir without repentance. The means are the end in itself, in a sense. Mm. So the means of the struggle, we intend to win. It's the winning that becomes the end. And it's an utter perversion of the deep and profound Christian morality. Because, of course, if might was right, then there would be no incarnation. We would have Muhammad, we'd have Thor, or rather we'd have Allah and Thor. But the incarnation, the potency behind it, is to persuade people that if you resort to might, then you get corrupted. And as you quite rightly said, that's what Galadriel stands for. And it's all the more beautiful that she's a woman and that she's skilled in elven lore and spirituality and Akka magic in that sense. And the idea you could present a kick-ass teenage angst Galadriel who's just going to get her own way by virtue of her strength. It's a complete inversion of Tolkien and what he intended to write.
I suppose part of the issue, though, in a sense, is how, shall we say, Amazon-adjacent people have spoken about Tolkien, as in sort of some of the executives and some of the producers and some of the actors say, well, he never really wrote about women. There's no women really involved. And I think that's a very interesting point, because while it does fundamentally seem what they're actually saying is that for a woman to be strong, they need to be able to beat up orcs as well as men can, which, I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, I mean, they can, fine. But it's interesting that it reduces, well, women to essentially having to become men to be successful. She's a sort of, well, yeah, as you say, Boromir, I was going to say twisted Aragorn, but yes, I mean, it's physical might is the only real kind. She's also extremely manipulative, let's not forget that.
But they're wrong about Tolkien not writing about women. But Arwen and Galadriel are two of the most inspiring characters in the book. They're profoundly important. And we know from Tolkien's own personal life how falling in love at an early age, he was no misogynist, by quite the opposite. But it's this proportionate thing. There weren't as many women as men. And so, but the reason there weren't as many women as men was because this was a quest. And in the days of quest, before technology had made it safe for women to have white goods, women looked after the home. And this was a quest about where you leave home. You leave home and you go away from home to fight some external battle. So in mythic language, there would not be many women doing it. But the women that are the most extraordinary multi-layered heroines who face their own moral dilemmas with their own skill.
This thing which I find intriguing is that those are the two women characters that are both most sort of thought of, but the one which always I find probably the most intriguing person is Eowyn, even if it's a case of they've tried to write Galadriel into this kind of hero aspect because Tolkien didn't write about women. They've missed the most obvious woman to choose. Eowyn sort of starts off in this sort of state of despair at the world and sort of being shackled to what are fundamentally domestic concerns, looking after the people. And yet she is the one who kills the most mighty of all of Sauron's lieutenants. And it's always amazing how frequently this is forgotten. But I think the fundamental issue with that is that there is that moment between Aragorn and Eowyn, where Aragorn goes into the Dwemerberg to go and pursue the armies of the dead, which in itself, there are theological issues that I look forward to hearing your views on. You know, she says, he asks her, what do you fear, my lady? I fear being hidden in a cage, being stuck in a cage, but where all hope of valor is, valor and renown are lost. And as Aragorn about heads off, they push that narrative a bit further on, that conceptual sort of framework. And she says, she basically says, why must I sort of stay here? I want to fight. I mean, she's capable. She's skilled with a sword. You must be able to fight. And he says, well, look, I mean, we may not come back. We may lose. And then you will have to fight with no hope of renown to defend the people that are left. You'll have to fight for them. Songs won't be sung about it, but it won't be any less valorous for it. She doesn't go along with that, and she goes and becomes heroic. It is an exceptionally significant point.
Let me jump in and say that you very helpfully sketched out the arena, which is, of course, troubling the church enormously at the moment. You've talked about her having two vocations. I mean, one is the vocation to fight there and then, and she can do it. She's capable. But should it go the wrong way, she's going to be needed in order to maternally, carefully, healingly deal with the consequences of defeat. And neither are, if you're dealing in moral terms, neither are more or less valiant than the other. It just depends where you exercise your moral virtue in terms of where the plot has got to. And the problem we have in the Catholic Church at the moment is if you look at the disciples and you see Peter, James and John all making noise, but the most important of the disciples is Mary, like Galadriel, because none of this would have happened without her. And she got the moral choice right from the off in a way in which the disciples all constantly and slowly failed to do. And so in terms of sheer drama, you would say, well, Mary is not very important. She only appears at the very beginning and then at the very end and pops up in the middle. But actually, in terms of what the gospel is doing to human beings, she was the most important of them all. So it depends on whether you read it in terms of cinematography and a drama, in which case judging everything by volume, or whether you're looking for significance, in which case Mary becomes more important than Peter, more important than John. And part of the problem with the Reformation, the attempted Reformation in the church at the moment, is they haven't read Tolkien either. They're trying to do it cinematographically. It's the Amazon approach to Christianity that the progressives are producing. Void of moral quest.
Mm. Yeah, if I just may slightly go back to the Eowyn point, just because the conclusion of her arc is often labelled as, women should stay in the home. Which is a very peculiar thing. So after she's had this great combat and great victory, she's taken to the Gardens of Healing, and she meets Faramir. She falls in love with things that grow, and she's given an excuse to sort of, I suppose it is a case of taking on a more maternal aspect. But what comes out of this arc is that they both end up living in a part of Gondor, irrelevant where, and she dedicates herself to growing things, and they have a garden, and it comes across as fundamentally domesticating if one looks at it on the sort of the simplistic front. But it shows a transition between that pagan, the pagan virtues that Tolkien so admired, in the Rohirrim, and their transition into, I suppose, a sort of a more mature and more profound form of living. But it is, again, so often due to the politics of that rather than actually looking at, as you say, the significance. And so I think, I suppose essentially where I'm going with this is I wonder whether the reason it's been so poorly rendered in the Rings of Power, would you say that that's because it's a simple case of people lack the understanding of it? Because, I mean, from the interviews that one has seen of J.D. Payne and Patrick Mackay, who wrote it, they clearly do love the world of Tolkien. It's not for me to doubt it. They start every day with a quote from Tolkien. They're utterly inspired by him. But it's a case of they love the world, but they don't understand what to look for. They don't understand the language. They haven't got the language, with the greatest respect, intellectually, to engage with the real themes and the significance of actually putting those themes seamlessly through story.
They understand the text immensely well and very skillfully, but they don't get its meaning. They don't know what it means. And because they're looking for something else. And this is a great tragedy of the way in which Tolkien's been received. He wrote so powerfully in terms of introducing people. I think one of the best quotes I heard was that Tolkien's world of the Shire is more real than any Shire world you can find. Every so often I find myself coming through the Malvern Hills and up through Shropshire, and this is all Tolkien country. And beautiful as it is, and I keep on thinking, yes, there could be orcs around the corner or elves here. This is completely Tolkien landscape. But it's not as real as the Tolkien landscape in the book. And the reason for that is that Tolkien, in the most extraordinary way, managed to tap into the archetypes. So in other words, it's a bit like if I was to say to you, draw me a picture of a straight line. Is that a perfect straight line? No, it's not, because it's drawn by a human being. How do you know it's not? Have you ever seen a perfect straight line? No, I've never seen a perfect straight line. Well, then how do you know what a straight line? The answer is we have the perfect straight line in our head. This is Plato, the form, the archetype. We know ultimate beauty. And what Tolkien does in his writing is he gets closer to the Shire than any Shire could be. And so his world is, and his heroism, his warriors, his sense of quest, his sense of moral virtue is so developed that when we enter his text, we're caught along in the slipstream of his insights and his wisdom. And we live off the clarity of his vision. And he would say, and he did say, well, this isn't my vision. It got written through me. In other words, this is an act of the kingdom. This is another representation of the gospel or the Bible. We're learning about the other world that breaks into this world. And one of the ways it breaks in is through these, either, if you're a Platonist, as I am, forms and archetypes. Archetypes if you're a Jungian. Music does this, as Lewis quite rightly said. Music is one of the ways in which the whole drama of the other world is introduced to us and leaves us with a longing. Sehnsucht was the word he used. So we want to pursue it. If you've read Tolkien and you've begun to understand it, the next place to go is Jesus and the Gospels, because that's where it's all put out in language that is no longer implicit, it's explicit. And the great tragedy for the people who've read Tolkien, I don't think it's that they lack the intellect, and they might or might not lack the intellectual insight. They lack the spiritual or the moral insight into what Tolkien was doing. They've experienced it, but they haven't identified it, and so they can't reproduce it. And, you know, that's one reason why the Inklings were so extraordinary, because this is exactly what Lewis was doing in Narnia too. Tolkien was much more wary of writing symbolically or allegorically in the way that Lewis did more. But it's precisely because through Tolkien we have all the virtues of God and God's creation and godliness, but without the signs, the signposts. For the signposts, for the interpretative semiotic instrumentation, you need to go to the Gospels. That's what Jesus does. That's the whole point of him. One of the things the church should have been doing, as lamentably failed to do, is to say, if you want to understand Frodo and Aragorn and Sauron and Gollum and Boromir, you need to come to the Gospels. They're all there. All the moral struggles. If you want to meet Galadriel, let us introduce you to Our Lady, because Galadriel is not the same as Mary, but there's an enormous overlap. So I think part of the problem is that the entertainment industry has settled for might is right and entertainment and cheap archetypal drama and failed to understand this inner life of the spirit. Basically, they haven't got the magic, have they? That's what it is.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's an eminently fair point. I noticed recently that Christopher Tolkien didn't actually appreciate the Lord of the Rings films. And again, it's not something one can imagine. Having raised on it, it's sort of like nectar to us. I mean, you know, my generation is sort of totally in love with it. But the more you look at it, the more you realise that it cannot be done properly. And inevitably, the studios will interfere and will demand bigger battles, more entertainment, more flash, more gore, you know.
But so long as it takes you to the text, and so in your case, it worked very well. The six-year-old Ferdy said, I like this stuff. And as he grew up, found sufficient moral courage to read the book, and you did. So I don't resent the Jackson films at all. In fact, I don't even resent the Amazon one. If there's any chance at all that people then move from that to reading the book, and from the book they get introduced to the real world, and if they get introduced to that real world, then one hopes that they might find their way ultimately to the Bible, and particularly to the Gospels. Jesus is so much more interesting than Gandalf.
Again, I defer to you, Gavin, on the theology of this, but there are three Christ figures, are there not? There's Frodo, Aragorn, and Gandalf. They all represent one element, do they not?
Yes, of course they do. That's exactly right. It wasn't until I was started reading for our conversation that I realised that Gandalf was technically an angel in Tolkien's mythology. And so for magician, read angel. So Tolkien's angelology is even more exciting than Aquinas is. But you're quite right. Tolkien is not trying to imitate. In the same way that Lewis made Aslan a Christ figure and said, you know, here is the embodiment of the Messiah, of the incarnate Logos, Tolkien quite rightly has spread out the archetypal virtues in a wider group of people. That doesn't mean that they're any less meaningful, but it's not a copy of the Gospels. You're right.
I think he consciously didn't mention God, as in a God as such in The Lord of the Rings, was because he wanted the sort of the ideas to speak for themselves.
He's writing history. He's writing mythic history. And so in this mythic history, God has not made himself known yet. I mean, there's pantheism, panentheism, theism, paganism. And what he does is he produces a Christian landscape with full of Christian moral virtue, but without any of the signs. So, because there's been no revelation. So instead of miracles, you get providence and destiny. You get the inner hand of God working through a mixture of circumstances and people's moral choices. We can put labels on that, but the reality was always the same. So he's always describing Christian reality.
I suppose I didn't mean as sort of God as such, but I mean in terms of they don't even reference the in-world gods.
It's a canvas with all the religious life penciled in rather than drawn in. It's there. You recognize it looking back, but you don't know what it is looking forward, which is historical authenticity. So thank you so much for coming to share your outrage and helping us discover why there was this outrage. I think I felt a bit of it when I first came across the original films. But in the end, as we both agreed, the thing to do is to get back to the text. So thanks, Ferdy, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for all the work you do as managing editor of the Catholic Herald. And thank you again for that splendid article, which I hope people will read because it explains everything we've talked about in fine detail. Ferdy, thank you for joining us this morning.
A great pleasure. Thank you.